What's up, everyone, and welcome to the 8th episode of Shooting the Breeze. I'm your host, Max Hooper, and the purpose of this podcast is for me to share my unique basketball experiences and perspectives while also sharing those of my guests. For those of you who aren't aware, my entire senior season at Oakland University, I did not attempt one two-point field goal, and I took a whole lot of threes, 257 of them, as a matter of fact. I have always prided myself in being a great shooter, and that is what continues to propel my basketball career. So, yep, you guessed it. On this show, we'll be talking shooting. Today, I have a very special guest. He's currently an assistant coach at Oakland University, and that's Drew Valentine. I've known Drew for quite some time now, as he was playing at Oakland when Coach Campy first started recruiting me. After his college career at Oakland University ended, he was a graduate assistant at Michigan State for two seasons under Coach Tom Izzo. He's currently in his second year as an assistant coach at Oakland. The basketball world sure is small. And after getting to know him initially in my own recruiting process, I had the opportunity to play under Drew during my senior year at Oakland. He and I will go into further detail on his playing and coaching career to date, what leadership means to him, what it's like to work for Coach Campy, amongst many other things. Without any further ado, what's up, Drew? Welcome to the show.
Max, like I told you, man, this is an honor and a true privilege to be on Shooting with the Breeze with the one and only three-point knockdown bow and arrow celebration man himself, Max Hooper.
All right. I love the intro. I might have to record an intro like that for you. But anyways, for those of you who aren't familiar, Drew is currently in his second year as an assistant coach at Oakland University. Was my coach last year, actually, in his first official season as a full-time assistant coach, college coach. So, Drew, let's rewind a little bit. Let's go back in your basketball journey and maybe start around, high school and then lead up into your college career. Let's just familiarize people who might not know, what brought you to the point of being in your second year as a assistant college coach right now?
Okay. Well, first of all, I grew up in Lansing, Michigan, the home of Michigan State University. And my father was a former player at Michigan State University. And that's why we grew up there. My family lived there, and I played at Lansing Sexton High School. And my father, who played at Michigan State and played professionally in a couple different countries, Sweden, Canada, just name a few, was my high school coach. And I also played football in high school as well. And coming up, I played AAU basketball for the Michigan Mustangs, and that was pre-Shoe Circuit, Adidas Gauntlet, Under Armour Association, and Nike EYBL. I played for Adidas-sponsored team and was fortunate enough to get a few different scholarship offers for basketball, but was also able to get a couple Division I scholarship offers for football as well. And so high school, first football game of my senior year, I was actually leaning towards playing football in college. I tore my ACL, and first football game, and then Coach Saadi Washington, that's actually at the University of Michigan now, that was an assistant coach at Oakland. Oakland was actually my first scholarship offer, probably somewhat similar to you, Max, from that respect, but it was a place that I always really loved, and Saadi and I had a really special relationship, and there was a lot of student athletes, Derek Nelson, Jonathan Jones, Eric Kangas, that were at Oakland prior to me being there, and I had seen the success that they were having, and so I always tracked and followed Oakland and knew a lot about the program. And after I tore my ACL, Oakland was the only school that hung in there with me after the ACL tear, so ended up signing with Oakland and had a great 4 years at Oakland. Made it to the NCAA tournament twice. Played on two teams that went 17-1 in the Summit League. Had a lot of great teammates. An NBA player, Keith Benson. Travis Bader, the all-time leader in three-pointers made. Reggie Hamilton, who led the nation in scoring. Jonathan Jones, who led the nation in assists. Duke Mundy, who led the NCAA in steals. So I had a lot of success. Ended up being a three-time captain at Oakland, and my most proud accomplishment at Oakland is that I'm currently, I'm replaced by some of the current players, but currently the winningest player in school history. After that, my college career ended. I decided to become a grad assistant coach at Michigan State under Coach Tom Izzo, and had a lot of success there as well. Was able to work with several NBA draft picks and NBA players. Was able to make an Elite Eight in my first year in 2014. Was able to make the Final Four in 2015. Had a great time there, got my master's degree, learned a lot from Coach Izzo and the entire staff there. Was able to help, like I said, develop players, including my brother Denzel Valentine, who's a rookie for the Chicago Bulls. And then after my time there, I was able to get hired by Coach Campy back as an assistant coach at Oakland. And we had a great year last year, led by Max as a senior captain. And this year, we just wrapped up our first Horizon League title in school history. So it's been a great ride that this game has given me, and I love the game a lot. And I'm very fortunate to be playing or be coaching at Oakland University.
Right. I love the detail. You know, a coach definitely breaks it down and is a little more wordy than my previous guests who are all players. You know, sometimes it's like pulling teeth. But what I want to zero in on is, so when in your mind did you know you wanted to be a college coach? You know, was that something that was always on your mind, or was it just kind of like, you know, as you started to get to the point, you know, my career is coming to an end here, what do I do? Or talk about your mentality with respect to coaching.
And at the end of my college career, my last 2 years, I actually had two meniscus tears. And during those meniscus tears, I wasn't able to be on the court. And when I originally got to college, like I said, I tore my ACL, and I really enjoyed the physical therapist that I had, a sports rehab guy that I had. Mm-hmm. And that was the career path that I thought I wanted to have coming into college. Mm-hmm. But once, you know, you start taking all those classes and doing all the work, you know, it was kind of hard for me. And then I kind of took a liking to the whole idea of being a sports broadcaster. So that's kind of what I wanted to do, be a broadcaster or a journalist when my playing career was over, mm-hmm. in my first 2 years. And then my last 2 years, when I had my knee injuries and I was sitting out of practice and I was just on the sideline, and, you know, riding the bike and talking to our coaches. I spent a lot of time with Coach Sorensen, Coach Darren Sorensen, who's one of our assistant coaches, as well as Coach Saadi Washington, like I mentioned before. And they started giving me ideas for, you know, some other things I could do instead of being a professional athlete. And those last 2 years really kind of led me to wanting to be a coach. And Coach Campy himself suggested the career path as well. And once the opportunity arose for me to go to Michigan State and learn under Coach Izzo, I just, you know, kind of thought that it was a perfect opportunity because, like I said, I love the game. I love being involved with it. I love the intricacies, the little things that go into making a team successful, into developing other young men to be successful as athletes and students at this level, and that's really where it all started at.
And the whole, you know, that's why it's great for me to have the chance to do this. You know, I didn't even know the whole thing about the knee injuries. And so do you think, you know, those knee injuries, and, you know, you're sitting out of practice, you know, you're itching to get back out on the court, do you think maybe your mindset changed as a player, you know, maybe thinking more of the game as a coach, or something, you know, thinking the game from maybe an elevated basketball IQ or something like that? Do you think that went into that as well?
Yeah, I definitely think so. And just like I said, spending a lot of time with our coaching staff and seeing what they were thinking while we were out on the court, seeing the reasoning to why certain adjustments were being made during the game in practice, you know, the reasons why you do certain drills in practice, the reason that certain individual, you recruited that player, the certain, you know, just a certain nuances and details of the game just really intrigued me and make me tick. And through those knee injuries, I was able to sort of develop some of my own thoughts and kind of my passion for my future career.
Right. Yeah. And I think, you know, as a young player, you know, a high school player, like just coming into college, you know, you always think, you know, oh, this coach doesn't know what he's talking about, or this, you know,
right.
This coach, if you're not getting the minutes, not getting the shots, you know, this coach is, you know, out of his mind. He doesn't know what he's talking about. But I think as you mature as a player, and as you, you know, whenever some people, maybe that happens early, some people it happens late, some people it never happens for. But I think once you can kind of, you don't necessarily have to think the game as a coach, but once you can kind of step out of your own, you know, you're out of your own way, and just, you know, at the end of the day, whether a coach plays you or not, the coach wants to win. And
right.
The coach has you know, the best interests of the team in his mind when he's putting players out on the court. So, like, you know, I think young players definitely, you know, miss the boat on that and just kind of think, oh, this coach, you know, he's trying to screw me. He's trying to mess with my rhythm. He's trying to – but I think at the end of the day, the coach just wants to win. And if he doesn't believe that you give him the best chance to win, then you're probably not going to be on the court.
And right.
So I think that's just something, you know, that a lot of young players don't pick up on. But I guess something that I should have gotten into earlier, but I'm just going to share real quick with the people listening, you know, the first time that I met you, Drew, was when, not as a coach, you know what I mean, was when
right.
You were still playing at Oakland. And, you know, people who have listened, I've shared my, you know, my journey on the podcast a little bit before, but, you know, it was crazy. And then Oakland recruited me early. And so my first impressions was, you know, Drew Valentine, probably you might have been a freshman, sophomore, I'm not exactly sure. But, and then, you know, you go through it, and I chose not to go to Oakland, and, you know, kind of out of sight, out of mind type thing. And then, funny enough, I don't know if you remember this, but when you guys were playing, was it Georgetown, I want to say, at the Garden, or someone at the Garden.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, I don't know if I got to say hi to you, but my dad was in the crowd, and, you know, spoke with you. And it kind of mm-hmm. like, you know, rekindle that thing sort of a little bit. I don't know. And then I'm like, you know, then sure enough, I end up going to Oakland. And then sure enough, my senior year, boom, you show back up. So it's just funny how this whole basketball thing works. You know, it's pretty crazy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Everybody's connected in the basketball world somehow, some way. There's always a connection. For sure.
Okay. So let's talk about the transition from being a college coach, I mean, from being a college player to becoming a college coach. It's, you know, it sounds pretty much basically what you shared so far. It sounds pretty seamless. You know what I mean? It's pretty seamless. And, you know, going to Michigan State and having familiarity with there. Talk about the transition a little bit, just from
yeah.
player into coaching.
Yeah. Well, my experience was pretty unique, being that my brother was on the mm-hmm. team
yeah.
that, I was, you know, making that transition on. And I think that's one of the things that really helped me mature as a coach, and separating guys that are close to your same age or the same age as you, and being able to have a mentor coach sort of relationship. It was tough at first. I mean, some of the things that guys are, you know, talking about, the off the court stuff, is kind of tough not to be involved in. But at the end of the day, you got to understand that this is your career, and if you want to be successful in it, there's sacrifices that you have to make. And I think that getting the opportunity to go up to Michigan State and work for Coach Izzo and work with my brother was one of the best things that ever happened to me. I was really able to learn how to separate the social aspect of being a kind of a big brother to being a coach, and being able to handle that relationship and that dynamic was something that really has helped me in my career moving forward.
Right. And you also, you know, coming back to Oakland, you have a unique perspective because no one else on the coaching staff at Oakland played for Coach Campy.
And no question.
No one has that, you know, they don't understand, you know, well, you know, they understand, but they don't know firsthand what it's like to be yelled at by Coach Campy. And what it's like to, not just that he yells, you know, not, I don't want to, you know, just say that he yells, but, you know, just, they don't understand what it's like to be directly coached by Coach Campy, and you do. So do you think that gives you some sort of leg up on, you know, other coaches, or does, that help more in recruiting? How do you, what factor does that play in you, into your, you know, being a coach?
I think that it helps me relate to the players and help give them the proper guidance mm-hmm. on the floor. I know exactly. I've been in a position with Coach Campy where I haven't been playing. I've been in positions where I'm trying to earn minutes for Coach Campy. I've been in position where I'm trying to learn his offensive system, his defensive system, and just trying to figure out the understanding of his whole system is something that I think I have a leg up on a lot of other coaches that could be in my position, just because not only did I play for him, but I played for him in this generation of social media and you know how you can anything that you're doing people are going to know about. So I think having done that, me being so fresh out of playing under him has really benefited me as a coach so far.
Right, yeah, it's not like you played for him 20 years ago and you're coming back and you know, relatively recently, 3-4 years ago, you were playing for Coach Campion and all of a sudden you're on the sidelines. And, you know, I think it's funny what the outsiders, all the Oakland people, all the Oakland players and coaches know, but what the outsiders don't know is that, you know, Coach Campion has run the same plays for 20, 25 years or whatever. And
right.
So I think it's really good for you to put yourself, you know, you can put yourself in the, you knew what you were doing as you're playing. You knew what the challenges were with a certain player. You know, when Coach Campy is asking you to do a certain thing, you know, what the little tricks of the trade that you can, you know, pass along to the players. And I think that's just a huge advantage because it's not like you're not trying to learn the system. You know, you got the system down pat. Whereas if you're going, say you didn't get the chance to go to Michigan State and go to Oakland. Say you're coaching it, I don't know, somewhere in Texas or Florida where you have no familiarity with the system or anyone. You know, you just had a connection and got the job. It's just two totally different, approaches and knowing the system and knowing expectations, all sorts of things in and out. I think just, you know, gives you a huge step up. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, in coaches, at least from a player's perspective, you know, as at a you know, when you got a staff of coaches at a certain school, you know, everyone kind of carves out their niche. You know, some guys are known as just the recruiter. Some guys are known as, oh, you want to get a workout in? Yeah, you go talk to him. Some guys are film junkies. Some guys are, X's and O's, whatever. So do you feel like there's one certain niche that you have that you enjoy more, like in the profession? Or I mean, obviously you do a little bit of everything, but you know, how would you describe yourself?
I would say that I'm just motivational and system guy.
I like it.
I would say that being able to, like you said, relate to the players and help motivate them and help them push them and help them get through situations is something that I feel like I do a pretty good job at. I think that bringing energy to the floor every day through, you know, being able to move around and get out there and play a little bit is something that I can do. I feel like, you know, whenever there's young players that need to walk through plays or need help understanding plays, I'm always the go-to guy for Coach Campy for stuff off the court, for outside of basketball. I think that Coach Campy trusts me and he knows that I can help him get that done. So I would say that just from a motivational standpoint and from a system standpoint, I think that's kind of my role in at Oakland right now, or right. The best thing that I do. Obviously, recruiting is something that I think that I do a pretty good job at as well, but being able to understand the system and motivate the players and help them get in the proper situations is something that I do as well.
Perfect. And I like how you brought the recruiting thing up, because that was what I wanted to talk about next. So in going through the recruiting process, I think there's, you know, obviously everyone has their own, you know, criteria, what they're looking for. And I think there's a few one way to generalize it is, you know, I came up with just three things. You know, there's an overall player's talent level.
Right.
What are they, you know, character? Are they high character? Are they good guys? Are they good off the court? Going to be a non-issue? And then how well did they fit the program from a basketball standpoint, and how well do they fit the community? So I think, you know, fit, talent level, and character are three things, but like, how do you weigh those, or like, what's your mindset going into recruiting? Where do those things fit in?
Well, I think fit is number one. I think that's the ultimate tool in recruiting one thing that I learned from a coach young in my career when I was at Michigan State was the head coach is going to be the main person that decides. I think the exact quote was, if the head coach doesn't love you, don't go there.
Right.
So that's something that I try to really emphasize in recruiting is figuring out if this person is going to be somebody that is going to fit what Coach Campy is trying to get done out on the court, and as a person as well. So is he going to fit with the team from a teammate perspective? Is he going to be a good teammate? Is he going to cause problems within our team? Is he going to mess up our culture that we have? And it is, you know, certain things that Coach Campy loves, like you, for example. Right. Coach Campy loves shooting, and he's always pretty much had, you know, other than this year, he's had somebody like you that's a marksman out there that can just knock shots down and can run sets to get shots for. So is this person gonna fit that? Is he gonna fit that position? And so that's something that I really value, and that's ultimately my number one, because if I were to get a job at another place, I don't want to have to feel awful about the student athlete that I'm recruiting being at Oakland, because at the end of the day, Coach Campy loves them just as much as I do.
Right. And so, you know, obviously, you know, you're just getting started, and but you're very young in your career. But what about a scenario where, you know, a guy is just, you have the opportunity to get a guy and he's just so talented, but you know, maybe there's some character question marks, or, you know, he maybe doesn't, you know, maybe you're over recruiting the position, but he's just so incredibly talented. What do you think is the thought process with that? Even if you haven't run into that scenario yet, what do you think is the thought process going? It's a tough scenario, you know?
Right. Well, I think that the if there's character issues, the talent has to really outweigh him. Like, he's got to be the best player, most talented player on our team, and somebody that's going to be an all-conference player, at least if there's going to be any sort of character issues, because you don't want to have baggage or problems with somebody out on the floor or, you know, off the court that's not going to produce on the floor. And we really don't want to take guys that really have character issues. But if there's situations where guys make one mistake, and you know the kid from previously recruiting him, you know the high school coach, you know the AAU coach, you know people, you know his family members, you know, and you know what kind of character kid he is, and you know that he just made a mistake, then that's somebody that you can take a chance on. But if it's a kid that you know that has had repeated problems and has had a history of disrupting high school program, AAU program, or, you know, a previous college program, then those are kids that we definitely don't want to be, or, you know, bring around the good kids on our program, because one bad seed can be a cancer and can spread to other parts of your program.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, it's just, it's not as cut and dry as I made it sound, you know what I mean? It's not
right.
Like, well, this kid's a great kid and he can't really play, and this kid's a, you know, an All-American, but he's I don't know, getting arrested every weekend. You know, it's just like, there's just, it's all, you know, the dynamic, how does he fit into the team, and it's all about, you know, creating, which I think has been created, and now, you know, just continuing the culture that's been established, and recruiting plays a huge part in that, because, you know, your program becomes who you, you know, allow into it. And there's, you gotta have great kids. You gotta have good character, because otherwise, you know, you got all sorts of internal issues and all sorts of crazy stuff going on. And it's just, you know, a question that I think about, you know, a lot is a kid so talented that you're going to be able to sacrifice some things? And, you know, sometimes the answer is no, So next, I wanted to talk about on the recruiting front, but not from the coach's perspective. So a lot of players these days, and I've asked multiple people on the podcast about this, a lot of players these days, if you're getting recruited at a certain level, the mid-major level consistently, if you wait around long enough, for the spring of your senior year, some of these high majors who, have missed out on the recruits and, you become, their third, fourth, fifth option, and all the kids have said no, and then finally, we got to get a player. They're desperate, and a big school comes calling. It it feels good. It feels good to have, these brand name schools come calling. And so, what do you give someone maybe a look into the mind of an 18-year-old who probably should go to a school, like Oakland, and where they can play and contribute and all sorts of things. You probably have a lot of phone calls like these days, but then kids, who get, excited because a Big Ten school called them, an ACC school called them, or whatever, and end up going to a school that might not be as good of a fit as a school that was originally recruiting them, but and then end up having an experience there that, they weren't satisfied with. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, well, like I said, my number one thing in recruiting is fit. And I think that's definitely something that every single kid that's being recruited, whether it's a JUCO level, whether it's a D2, D3, NAIA, or Division I level, or high major, mid major, whatever the level that you're being recruited at may be, I think that understanding, is the head coach going to love how you play? Does your game fit the system that he runs? Are the players that you're going to play with, do they are they going to complement you well and help you flourish? Are you going to complement them well? So I think that just understanding that dynamic is the most important thing. And sometimes when you wait around, you end up missing out on an opportunity that you've had before, and then you end up wanting to transfer back to those situations. I think that at the end of the day, although if you're being recruited to a certain high major, let's say you're getting recruited to a Big Ten school, but in the Big Ten, that school is going 5-13, I think that it's more fun to probably play a little more minutes, a lot, maybe a little or a lot more minutes at a mid-major school, a really good mid-major school that plays on national TV, that does get recognized, but might go 14-4 in their conference, and you're winning and being able to play a lot. I think that is a more happy lifestyle rather than going just to a Big Ten school just to go there because of the name.
Right, and I think that comes down to the kid. What does the kid want? I guess if a kid wants to, go to a school and, hopefully work really hard and maybe play minutes as a senior if he's lucky, then maybe that works. But I think, the kids, if you're at any, respectable D1 school, you want kids who want to be pros. You know what I mean? You want kids with aspirations and kids who are going to work hard and come with a purpose and, have dreams that they want to fulfill. And you can't do that from the bench. So you got to go somewhere where you can play. And I mean, and we saw it firsthand. You know what I mean? Kay Felder, I'm sure if he would have waited around, he could have, one of these, middle of the road high majors would have grabbed him up and give him a shot. But he went to a school where he was going to play. He was going to be in a system that fit his style of play, getting up and down the floor and, allowing ball dominant point guards to do their thing. And now he's where he's at. So, it's not about what school you go to. And frankly, it happened to me, because I got excited when a Big East school was calling me and I had the opportunity to play in Madison Square Garden. And Madison Square Garden doesn't look so nice from the bench. Believe me, it doesn't look so good from the bench. So I think, and I honestly think that issue is going to get bigger and bigger as the social media, oh, I got this scholarship offer, this offer. It's almost like. It's almost like, kids
It's all
are,
for show.
and it's like, oh well, this school's calling me, and they're in the Pac-10, the Pac-12, and they're in the Big 12. But really, the school you should probably be going to is in the Horizon League or the MAC or something that's not a sexy pick. But if you go there and do your thing, then at the end of the day, you'll be grateful that you went there. So I just think that's a, I just like to get everyone's perspective on that because it's, an interesting thing. So, We've gone a while into this podcast, but this is called Shooting the Breeze, and with me, Max Hooper, I'm a 3-point shooter, so we gotta get into some shooting discussions.
You know?
When you're evaluating a high school player, give me three keys that you might look at to determine what type of shooter is this kid. What would be three things that you would look at?
I would say first of all, just the form of his jump shot. Mm-hmm. I would say the release point of it. Is it behind his head? Is it in front of his face? You know what I'm saying? Kind of seeing how, if it looks smooth, if it looks broke. And then the second part would be the release, because some people might have a bad form, but if their release is good, if the ball's coming off their fingers and they're snapping their wrists and they're getting decent rotation on the ball, then they could be a good shooter. And then I would say the last thing would be the balance and angles that they can shoot. Can this kid run off screens and shoot, or is this kid just going to be a spot up shooter? Is this kid can he shoot well off the dribble but not on the catch? So I would say his form, and then the release, and then the balance or the angles that he can shoot from.
Yeah, in college, obviously, high school, not so much, or depends on what level of high school you're playing at. But in college, if you're a shooter, and I mean, you do this, you when someone gives a shooter an open shot, you got to get on the player, you got to yell at the defender, what the hell is wrong with you? No shots,
right.
So, I mean, as a high school player, if a guy's hitting shots, but he's got this, slow release where he's not really dynamic, he can't really move around and shoot, then, you might not, really grade him out as being that great of a shooter. Because if you can make him, but you can't get him off, who cares in college?
Right.
And then obviously as you progress beyond college, then you got to be able to free yourself to get the shots off. So I think that's something that goes into shooting. And also with the shooting, confidence, mentality. Does the kid get phased when he misses a few, or is he going to keep firing him because he has the ultimate confidence? And I think go ahead.
And what you said right there is probably the most important part of shooting. It's the confidence. And I know I talk more, about the intricacies and from a technical standpoint, but having confidence is the number one thing in a shooter that we look for. Is this guy, if he gets a second, is he looking to fire that joint up? And if he misses, is he going to keep shooting? Or, if he's not shooting it well, how do his teammates take his misses? Do they still want to get him the ball? How do his coaches take his misses? How do his coaches take his makes? Mm-hmm. So confidence is definitely the most important part of being a shooter.
And I think through my experience, I've developed an appreciation for a coach who creates an environment that a shooter can thrive in, because, I mean, sometimes, you got to be able to do this, but it's hard to come in, cold off the bench and fire one up and be able to bury it. And it's hard to shoot without a rhythm, It's hard to shoot without, knowing that you're going to get a few chances. And what Coach Campy creates for, his shooting specialist is just for the free reign, the ultimate. Once you've earned it, he gives you the ultimate free reign to let it rip. And because he knows that when he has a guy with that ability, he knows he's going to create those nights when you hit 10, 9 to 8, 9, 10 threes, and where you just blow the roof off the building. And
right.
And that's all, but the coach and the teammates have to create that. But it also, what it's founded in is the work that you put in. That I think that's where the confidence comes from as a shooter. And obviously you were a hard worker, but you saw firsthand Travis Bader, the type of work that he put in on a daily basis. And anyone can just say, I have confidence in my shot, I believe it's going in. But when you've put in the work day after day after day, hundreds of thousands of shots and reps and visualizing yourself in the game scenario, that's where the confidence comes from. And I think that, you're not, if you, as a big time shooter, you're not brash or anything or too bold by saying, I believe every shot's going in. If you put in the work, then I think you deserve that. Do you agree with that?
I definitely agree, and I think you're a shining example of that. I mean, There's probably, I got a short list probably of the hardest working people that I've seen as a basketball player in my young career as a coach, as a player. Yeah, as a coach and as a player. You know, Travis Bader is up there. Yourself is in the group as an incredibly hard worker. Reggie Hamilton, I would throw in that group. And then Bryn Forbes and my brother Denzel Valentine are two other guys that really worked their butts off to become really good players and turned out to be NBA players when, you know, quite frankly, they didn't really, you know, from an athletic or talent standpoint, don't deserve to be up there. But like you said, they worked their butts off and they deserve the results that they got. So I'm truly a believer, as you are, and you get what you put into this game.
Right. And it's funny how you said, you know, you listed off your list of the hardest workers, but all of those players are knockdown shooters. You know what I mean? You've never met a shooter who isn't meticulous and who isn't, you know, obsessive about his craft. Or I haven't, frankly. You know, an elite level shooter who's, you know, bearing over 40%, you know, at, you know, high volume attempts. You never met someone like that who's not a crazy gym rat. You know what I mean? I don't think there's any such thing as really like a lazy knockdown shooter.
No question. You can't be.
Yeah, you can't be, because it's so different than, you know, attacking the rim with force. You know, it's a finesse thing. It's an art, really. And most, you know, most of the shooters tend to be, you know, not only gym rats, but also just very, very disciplined, routine oriented, and those sorts of things. And I think it's just interesting to look at that, because I've never really, you know, before I really thought about this, I never really thought about that. But then, you know, it's like, okay, well, it doesn't happen by accident. It doesn't happen by accident at all. And so the next question I want to ask you is something that I think, you know, Coach Campy and his system does perfectly, and, you know, does pretty much to a T. But what type of impact do you think a shooter has on a team, you know, directly through his shot making, but also just from the attention that he attracts from other players?
It's unbelievable when you have a guy that is a threat and is causing, like you said, so much attention from the defense. And you spoke about it earlier about how if a coach is on his players about do not let this guy get a shot, I think that's an awesome threat. I mean, you're even seeing it in the NBA. I mean, the Golden State Warriors are the best record team in basketball, and their game is predicated on the 3-point shot. And I think that shooting and being a threat to be a catch and shoot 3-point shooter, not allowing, you know, wide open spot up threes, is something that you have to have as a player at this level if you're going to play. And, you know, before it was, you know, maybe at two of the three perimeter positions, you had to have a threat of that. But now it's, you know, pretty much you're one through four have to be able to be guys that you don't allow to get a clean catch for three.
Right. And I think, you know, you just mentioned, I love being tagged as a shooter, you know, where the team has to run around and chase me, like, because, you know, one of your roles for Oakland, you know, is teaching the defense and teaching the you know, the defensive positioning where you're supposed to be. But a shooter distorts all that, because if you're supposed to be in a gap, you're supposed to be, you know, at the nail help, and you're guarding a knockdown shooter, you can't get to the nail help. And
right.
Especially, you know, at the highest levels of college, and, you know, even at the NBA level, you know, you can't be at the nail help if Kyle Korver or J.J. Redick, you know, is on the opposite wing. And,
right.
And it's just super interesting to me how it just distorts everything. And then your coach is like, you know, why the hell aren't you on the nail help? And then you help, and then the next time the guy's burying a three, why the hell didn't you close out? It's like, you got to pick your poison. And I think that all the thing that Coach Campy does so well is he realizes that, and then he preys on the other teams. You know, he knows where the help is going to come from or where it's not going to come from, and then, you know, attacks accordingly. And I think the success of his offense for so many years is a testament to that. And I think it's super interesting for me to kind of reflect upon now that I'm not playing for Coach Camp. You know, when I was there, I was just like, yeah, I just run around these screens. But now it's like, J. Jalen Hayes got so many open looks because of the way I ran, and then, you know, shit, you got so many open looks the way right. Travis Bader ran around, you know. So,
exactly.
It's just it's super interesting to me. So, you know, you as a player had a certain, like you said, three-time captain, had a certain leadership style. How does your like leadership style as a player translate into being a coach? Do you think it's pretty much, you pretty much play the same role essentially?
I would say it's kind of a little different. I would say that as a player, I was a little more laid back. I was somebody that was aggressive, but with my teammates, because I wanted them to have confidence in me, you know, belief from a captain's perspective that I believed in them. Some of the times I wouldn't be as hard on them as I am as a coach, because as a coach, it's not my job to give a player confidence. It's the player's job for me or for them. It's the player's job for them to give me confidence in them. Mm-hmm. So that, I would say that's kind of the difference. But as far as being very emotional, very energetic, and very passionate leader, I would say that those characteristics are all the same. But I would say I'm a little more aggressive as a leader, as a coach, but I was a little more laid back as a player.
Right, yeah. And I think leadership, you know, a lot of people, leadership is an interesting thing, especially in college basketball, because I think a lot of times, you know, whoever is the quote unquote best player is always just assumed, oh, he's the leader of the team.
Right.
And sometimes that's the case, and sometimes that's not the case, because I think a lot of leadership has to do with, you know, there's always the cliche thing, you know, are you a vocal leader or do you lead by example? And I mean, there's mixes of those things, because if you're naturally not, you know, an outspoken guy, then, and you're trying to be a vocal leader, then it's not going to be genuine. You know what I mean? It's not
right.
The teammates are going to look at him like, what the hell are you doing? Like,
right.
That's not you. That's not genuine. But then on the other flip side, I look at it as if you're a guy who's a vocal leader, but then you're not holding up at your end of the bargain. You know, if you're cussing someone out because they didn't get to help side, but you never get to help side, then who's going to respect that type of leader? So I think it's like, you know, your words and your actions have to, have to mirror each other. You know, you got to be the one who's, and to be a leader, you have to be the one who's in the gym every day and who brings it every practice. And but then there's also, you know, the vocal side. So I think leadership has so much that goes into it. And I can just see, like, now that, you know, I was a captain, but now that I'm out of it, out of college basketball, and I can just see how, you know, your leadership style would change being a coach, but also be pretty similar in a sense that,
right,
you know, you're just being yourself, and
right,
you represent yourself in that way, and it also stems from your actions. So to continue on the whole topic of leadership, I'm not going to put you on the spot, you know, or anything, but or hold you to this answer, but what are your career goals? You know, I mean, one day, do you want to be a head coach in college, or what do you see in the future for you?
I definitely want to be a head coach one day, whether that's at the professional level or the college level. I just want to keep learning and growing, and I want to be hopefully good enough to, you know, good enough as a coach, good enough as a mentor to hopefully be the leader of in the face of a program one day. And that's a pretty big goal of mine, because there's only 350 jobs in Division I and 32 in the NBA, or 30 in the NBA, excuse me.
Football.
And football. Sorry, I got it mixed up. And so there's not that many jobs. So it's a very elite, you know, to be named a head coach. But I think I have the work ethic and the support around myself to do so.
Yeah, no doubt. And I mean, it's not like you're just going to become a head coach overnight. You know, it takes years and years and years and time and learning. But, you know, I think anyone who wants to be great in any field, you got to have a vision. You got to have where do you ultimately want to be? And so, you know, some people, because I asked that question to players. You know, what do you see in the future when you're done playing? Because whether you're LeBron or whether you're Johnny on the junior varsity, your basketball career comes to an end, and you got to find somewhere to fill your time. And so, you know, that's awesome that you want to be a head coach in the future. And I think every experience that you have will push you towards that goal as you continue to progress. And, you know, obviously, who knows what the future holds immediately and in the long term. So we talked about it a little bit before, but and you alluded to your brother Denzel, Bryn Forbes, and Kay Felder. I think those would be the three NBA players that you've worked with to this date, correct?
Gary Harris as
Gary
well.
Gary Harris, my
yeah.
bad.
Yeah.
So those guys, what is there a unifying trait or something that stands out about those guys, or like did you know that those guys were destined for that? As soon as you came in contact with them, obviously the Denzel one, you're kind of biased
right.
towards, but you know the other guys, and I guess you knew Bryn from a young age, but so just talk about the you know what you see in those type of guys and what got them to that level.
When the lights come on, those guys take it to another level. Mm-hmm. Their competitive will to win, their competitiveness, their ability to embrace the moment and flourish in high pressure, high anxiety situations is elite. And I think that's what that's why they all get paid the big bucks is when the time comes for them to answer the ball. In every type of situation that they've been in, they've all, you know, been able to have success whenever their back has been against the wall. And I think it's all because of what we talked about earlier as far as the work ethic. And not only that, but just the confidence and the belief in themselves. They just all feel like anytime that they're on the floor that they're the best player. Whether they're not, whether they are the best player, they feel like they are. And when they need to respond in big moments, they always come up. So I think that's the biggest trait that I've seen in all NBA players that are in college.
Right. Obviously everyone's, you know, their own unique person. But I guess that's a good way of summing it up, that's something that definitely stands out. So that just about sums up what I wanted to talk about, you know, the main part of what I wanted to talk about. But something I didn't mention is that you are a sneakerhead. You are a big, very big sneakerhead. And, I mean, that's accurate, right?
I don't know about that, all that, Max, but, you know, I really appreciate you putting me in that category, man, because most people don't know about you is that you are a sneakerhead as well.
Even though
it's super low-key, you are
very
as well.
Key. I keep it under the radar, but so I think it's appropriate that I end all of my podcasts with the top three. You know, we're keeping it with the theme of threes. You know, I'm a 3-point shooter. That's what I do.
Oh yeah.
So we're keeping with the theme of threes, but we're gonna do our list of our top three numbered Jordans. So you'll give me one, I'll give mine, and we'll go back and forth and just, you know, so numbered Jordans, favorite Jordan. Of all time, go give me your number one.
My number one favorite Jordan model of all time is the one.
Oh, okay.
The Jordan one. That is my favorite sneaker of all time.
Okay, and why?
Point blank period. It is just the classic. It's what changed the sneaker game. It's
right.
what it's so iconic about Michael Jordan sneakers is it all started with that one. And you know, although they're not really a performance sneaker on court anymore, they are the most fashionable, in my opinion, of all the sneakers that you see. I mean, you can wear them with a suit, you can wear them with jeans, some people do play basketball in them still, but I just think that they are the best sneaker silhouette of all time.
Yeah, no doubt. I can't argue with you on that one. And like you said, change the game, you know, back in the day. Jordan would get fined big bucks to wear them before they allowed tricolor shoes. And
Right.
where was this? I think this was when we went on the trip to, remember when we went to the Nike campus?
Oh yeah.
And they had, what was it? I can't remember what it is, but Jordan wears like a size 13 and a half, but he didn't want his shoes to be that big. So the shoe itself was a 13 and a half, but they put the label as a 13, something like that. Something
right.
like that. And there was like a lineup of all these different Jordan 1s, and they told us that story. So I think that is funny. But my number one is number one favorite signature Jordan model of all time is 11s. Easily number 11s, you know, the patent leather. It's, you know, very comfortable. I mean, I don't play in them really much, but I used to play
right.
them when I was in high school. But very comfortable, just classy, you know, the Space Jam, iconic as well.
Yeah.
And then you got all the different colorways they come out with, the Conquerors, et cetera, but you know, just that's got to be my number one. Just pretty damn cold shoe. So what you got
right.
for number two?
My number two is the 11. I can't disagree with you.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, as far as the more modernized, although it is a retro, I think it is still pretty modernized. And,
yep.
And the Concord and the they call it the bread, but I call it the playoff.
Right.
Because that's what they were, you know, called back in the day, because, you know, I do love sneakers and sneaker mm-hmm. culture. I call it the playoff, but, you know, that's probably the playoff 11 is probably my favorite non-one of all time.
Gotcha.
But I gotta agree with you on that. What about you? What's your number two?
Number two is easily 13.
Ooh.
You know, I think a lot of it has to do with just also being a, you know, I was young, but seeing Michael Jordan play when I was, you know, 5, 6 years old, seeing him play in you know, against the Utah Jazz in the finals, wearing the 13, the black and red 13s, and I mean, I haven't, as time has gone on, my interest in sneakers has kind of declined because they've come out with so many different retro colors and so many
right.
different things. I mean, they're hot. Don't get me wrong. They're hot shoes, but I like to stick with the classics, you know, the black
no
and red ones, and then the white and black playoffs, and
ooh.
Probably
the
those
he
two.
Got the he got games, man. The Jake Shuttlesworths, man.
Oh yeah, those are pretty fire. And then they, you know, they've come out with some other ones, the altitude with the green sole and a few others, but the 13 is just
the French blues are iconic
ooh.
As well, man.
Yeah,
you
yeah,
can't
yeah.
forget about those.
Yeah, what are those? The Flints.
The Flints,
Flints right?
yeah, yeah, the Flints, yeah.
I like those. So what's your last one?
My last one would have to be the four.
Okay.
I love the
mine.
Four.
You're stealing mine.
I know, man. We just, you know, to me, the white cement fours are just, they're a great sneaker, man. You can play in them. You can wear them, you know, pretty much anything. They're just another iconic sneaker. And another one that, you know, he didn't do the first free throw line dunk in him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was the white cement three, but the
yeah.
second free throw line dunk in the 89 dunk contest was in the white cement four. And I think that shoe, the black ones, I think the black cat and pure money fours, the all white with the silver and the all blacks, I think those are two of my favorite shoes as well. So I would have to go with the four as my third favorite.
Yeah, can't go wrong. Well, I was gonna say four, but I guess because you said I'll say another one, I'll add in the 14 because it's also iconic with the last shot, with the pose,
right,
the follow through, Brian Russell on the ground.
oh yeah,
with the black and red. And I mean, they've come out with so many different editions, and then there's also some pretty dope player exclusives that I got my hands on. Jordan 14 Quentin Richardson editions when he was with the Knicks, with the white, blue, and a little bit of orange on there. So those are pretty hot. And I mean, those are comfortable as well. You know, some of the Jordans, the older ones, are kind of a little clunky, maybe a little
right.
clunky. But those were as you know, the sneaker technology was improving, and they were just pretty comfortable shoes, and they work for Mike. You know, he
right.
knocked down the last shot in them, so pretty hot sneaks. But
I definitely think the 14 is one of the more comfortable of the shoes to play in. I actually started my career, my high school career, playing in a pair of 14s, the all black last shots.
Yeah,
Yeah.
nice.
So those are definitely a great choice by you, Max.
Yeah, well, I had to switch it up on the end. You know, we talked a lot of hoops, a lot of shooting, a lot of recruiting, et cetera, et cetera. I had to, you know, get them a little taste of the sneaker culture and diversify a little bit. You know, that's the point of this. You know, share the perspectives that people can't get from, you know, looking at the box score or reading the interviews online. You know, we just want to share the perspectives. So, Drew, it's been a pleasure. You know, appreciate you joining me on here. We finally pinned down the time. I messed it up a couple times, and you know, our scheduling was a little iffy, but appreciate you joining on here, my man. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, yeah, Max. It's been a pleasure being a guest on Shooting the Breeze, my guy. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. We'll talk soon, okay?
All right, Max.
All right, later.
Yep. Yeah,